Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Witt, a senior fellow with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, and we are podcasting today from Texas, from the Dallas area, because we are hosting the Dallas Area Science and Faith Conference, and I'm pleased to have with me, in the chair next to me, one of my favorite intelligent design writers, Michael Behe of Lehigh University. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks, Jonathan. It's great to be with you.
Many of you may be familiar with Michael Behe's work. He, again, is a professor at Lehigh University. He wrote the groundbreaking book, Darwin's Black Box, also the excellent book, The Edge of Evolution, and most recently, Darwin Devolves. Excellent works. His lively writing, his insight as a scientist come together to make for just spectacular books and groundbreaking. He's been called the father of intelligent design. Now, we were at a dinner last night where there might be some arm wrestling for that, because we had the three authors of the 1984 groundbreaking book, The Mystery of Life's Origin, which is in some ways was a seminal intelligent design book, along with Evolution, A Theory, and Crisis.
Yeah.
So what we could do, though, is we can say that Thaxton, Bradley, and Olson, and maybe Michael Denton, are the grandfathers of the ID movement, and you're really the father. So then you also, you get to, you know, look younger. But there's no question that you're, oh, and by the way, Phil Johnson is often referred to as the godfather of the intelligence, because he brought everybody together, the Berkeley law professor.
Well, like John Kennedy said, success has many fathers, but failure has none.
So by the looks of the crowd here this morning, we had a line nearly going out the door. We have a lot of people that were in the walk-up line. So we're actually doing it in a suburb of the Dallas area, Denton Bible Church. It's been an excellent turnout, a lot of energy. Looking forward to your two talks. You're going to be talking about your Darwin Devolves book first, and then a little bit later in the youth track, going to be talking about Darwin's Black Box and laying out, summarizing that argument. So that's going to be fun. I want to zero in. We could go so many directions. Any one of your three books, we could get dozens of podcasts out of. I just want to zero in on one particular statement by Charles Darwin, because it turned out to be seminal in your original book, Darwin's Black Box. It's where he talks about a way to disprove his theory of evolution. And the way he offers also applies to the modern version of that theory, I would say, neo-Darwinism. Can you summarize or quote his statement?
Yeah, it was at the end of a section when he was dealing with a vertebrate eye. And everybody knew that the eye was really snazzy and complex and so on. And he had put forward a story where he said that the eye could gradually form, not all at once or not as parts, its modern day parts. And at the end, he said if it could be demonstrated that any organ or system could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. And he added, but I can find out no such case. So he kind of threw the burden of proof onto his opponents to prove that something could not possibly happen, which of course is impossible to do. But nonetheless, you can point to many things, especially at the molecular level of life, and I'm a biochemist, that's where I like to think, many systems that need, absolutely require multiple components in order to work. And I coined a term called irreducibly complex for those systems.
Yeah, where you need all of it, like a mousetrap.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, so Darwin, in one sense, he puts the burden of proof on the other side. You've got to, you know, prove, you can absolutely prove, whereas science is more about probabilities, best explanation, coming up with evidence that weakens another argument, particularly with the historical sciences, where you're looking at things it's difficult to go back and see them in action. So you have to recreate, try to create models in the lab, that kind of thing. But a couple things struck me about his statement. On the one hand, he's trying to unload the burden of proof onto his opponents, when no one has, certainly at the time he wrote this, and we'll discuss about if that's changed in the intervening 160 years, certainly at the time he wrote this, nobody had ever observed any complex organism evolving through a series of small changes through blind processes. So it's kind of strange that he would put the burden of proof on the other side. It would be like saying, you know, nobody can, and if anybody can prove there are no leprechauns anywhere in the universe, then I'm happy to go along with them. But until you prove unequivocally that there's not a single leprechaun in the whole universe. So he's a little bit fast and loose there, I would
That's
say.
That's right. Well, he was a good rhetorician.
Yes, good rhetorician.
He was good at defending his argument against, and people at that time didn't know what to do with it because they hadn't heard such a thing before. He got a lot of criticism, too, because he wasn't supporting his own argument so much as pushing other arguments out of bounds, calling them unscientific.
Right. So that was another move he made, you know. Invoking design was unscientific. And so trying to kind of win by definition.
Yes.
Which is a nice game if you can get it. There's another part of his statement, though, that strikes me at least, as somewhat generous, and that is, he says, if you can just find one, you know, presumably, according to his theory, all these organs and organisms, you know, from bird's wings to the heart to the brain, the eyesight, et cetera, all of it was produced through the Darwinian process of small mutations, random variation, and natural selection. But he's saying, all you have to do is just find one that can't be explained. And it struck me, that's rather generous of him. And then I got to thinking, there's a sense in that, though, because if you look at Darwin's notebooks, and particularly some of his letters, it's clear that his theory of evolution was meant to be a designer substitute. It was meant to borrow the words of the Harvard geneticist Richard Lewontin, to keep a divine foot out of the door. So you don't want, Darwin wouldn't have been happy to say, oh, my theory of evolution explains a lot of stuff, but then there's quite a few things where it was clearly intelligent design. He didn't want to have anything to do with that. He wanted to completely keep the designer out.
Right. He said in a letter once that if evolution required guidance or intervention at any point, he would consider his theory worthless.
Right. So that clearly spells out what his goal was. It was to keep design completely out of it. And so he's being kind of honest here in saying, if you just find one good example. Now, he puts unfairly puts the burden of proof on our side, but he does say even one. Now, interestingly, I don't know, you said that you're part Irish, so I don't know if that has anything to do with it or if you're just a tough guy, you like a challenge. You actually accepted his challenge in a way and said, you know what, I will go and show what? At least that it's highly improbable, very unlikely that certain features of the natural world could have evolved in this way.
Sure. Approaching it from a scientific, not some logical / philosophical way, you can say there are a lot of things that sure don't look like they could be put together in a gradual fashion, improving things slowly and the same, having the same function or job. And back to the mousetrap, if you try to put a mousetrap together gradually, you know, it doesn't work until it's all together. And there are lots of things at the molecular level that are exactly like that. Back in Darwin's day, of course, they didn't know about molecules. They barely knew about cells. They thought they were protoplasm. And it turns out that the molecular level is where the rubber meets the road in life. And in Darwin's black box, perhaps the best illustration is the bacterial flagellum. For that principle, it's really a molecular machine. It's an outboard motor. It's gotten a lot of publicity, so maybe many people have heard about it. And it sure doesn't look like it could be put together by numerous successive slight modifications because it needs a bunch of different parts in order to work. And so I put that forward as something that, well, it might meet Darwin's own criterion.
Yeah, and what struck me as I was thinking about what's so good about the bacterial flagellum as an example, it's not that it's the most amazing structure. It's that it's simple enough that you can get your head around it. You can see a picture of it. It looks like an outboard motor. You also talk about the blood clotting cascade in Darwin's black box. You talk about vision. And it's interesting that Darwin even took a crack at how vision might have evolved. Mm-hmm. But knowing what we now know about what's involved for vision, it's laughably simple. Didn't you even just take one little aspect of vision, right, if I recall?
Yeah, that's correct. What, you know, again, Darwin didn't know anything about the molecular basis of life, so he was talking in terms of what we call today gross anatomy. You know, if, you know, something looks like this, could it change to look like something else? But if you look at the molecular level and you ask, you know, what happens when a photon comes and hits your retina, well, it has to interact with a molecule called retinal, and the retinal has to bind to something and change its conformation, and that change causes it to do something else, and it's extraordinarily complicated. And so it's kind of like saying, you know, how does a computer work? And somebody who doesn't know says, well, you need a screen and you need a
Kind of glassy and you need some plasticky parts.
But when you get down to the electronics of it all, it's grossly more complex than that.
Right. And of course, vision is even more than just like a camera eye. It's got to interface with a brain. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it has no function.
Right.
Now, why small successive? And why do they each have to be functional? Somebody might say, well, maybe Darwin's being too hard on himself. Well, why not make big jumps and why not have him not do anything until you get it all together?
Yeah, well, it comes back to the fact that he didn't want any guidance. He didn't want any divine foot in the door. He knew that if things seemed to improve in large leaps, it would look suspiciously as if somebody were guiding it, as if something other than chance were involved.
Yeah, like if you came upon a Scrabble board and the whole board was spelled out in this wonderful game with all these great words, you wouldn't think, boy, that fell onto the board, and isn't that nice? There's too much there that came together.
That's right. Yeah, and same thing with things changing kind of without selection, and then kind of at the end fitting together all at once to form some complex system. That's essentially the same problem as forming it in one fell swoop. The odds are much against it. His brilliance, or his really appealing thing, is that he tried to break down the improbability into tiny steps so that one step isn't so improbable that it couldn't happen, and then maybe another one comes along. But turns out the intelligence comes along when you say, well, then the next step will be this, what I decide, and I have this distant goal in mind of producing an eyeball or something, and it turns out that nature doesn't work that way.
So, right, and so you deal with all that, you know, natural selection, it's got to select something that's functional, that works, that's, hopefully even helpful, but to do that, you need something functioning, and you're pointing to all these various systems where you need all the parts to function. Mm-hmm. Now, we have some Darwinists out there listening, they're probably going, well, there's counter-arguments to all this. There's things like co-option where you grab other stuff. We don't have time to go into that this particular session. There are other podcast episodes where we've dealt with that. You actually, which I find interesting, is even with your original Darwin's Black Box, they would later bring up, oh, co-option, you didn't talk. Well, you actually dealt with it in there. I think maybe you used some other term, and so they went to the index and decided you hadn't. But you already dealt with that. And you'll often, I've heard people say, why doesn't Michael B. answer his critics? And in fact, you have answered them extensively. And we were talking at dinner last night when we had various ID luminaries there. I felt very privileged to be there. You were there, the original authors of The Mystery of Life's Origin there. Stephen Meyer were there. Doug Axe. It was great. And we were talking about how some of them will make this claim. Why don't you answer these people? Many of these are actually available online. Mm-hmm. Some of them are in journals that are behind paywalls, but you've answered them extensively. The pattern seems to be, and correct me if I'm wrong, somebody will attack your one of your books, often in a way that seems as if they haven't even read it carefully or at all. Then you will patiently answer, and then some crickets.
Yeah.
You don't get the rebuttal, which you would expect if you were making really weak arguments. You'd expect them to come back. Sometimes you'll maybe get one reply, but it often just dribbles off when you patiently go through an answer. Has that been your experience?
Yeah, it has. It's real disappointing if you want to actually discuss ideas in the public square. It's much more like politics than it is like academics. Yeah, in my completely unbiased opinion, I make an argument, and this kind of engenders a glib, just-so story that somebody says, well, this answers your argument. And I go back and show why that doesn't answer it, why it brings up other problems, whatever.
Sometimes by pointing to arguments that were actually in the book already that they just hadn't bothered to read carefully.
Exactly. And my replies are ignored, and the first rebuttal is cited, years later to show that my original argument was wrong. And so you don't actually get people engaging in this. A lot of guys just want this idea of design to go away. They don't want to think about it. They don't want to deal with it. They just want it to go away.
So some good news on this front is, correct me if I'm wrong, is it in The Edge of Evolution or Darwin Devolves where you do answer some of the critics of the...
Yeah, it's in Darwin Devolves that I have in a chapter-length appendix going back and say, well, this book, Darwin Devolves, is more than 20 years after Darwin's Black Box. Let's see what the criticisms of my arguments from back in that area, how they have held up. And I show that, in fact, nobody has worked on these problems since offering the initial counter replies, many of which says, well, in the future, we'll figure this out. And nobody has figured it out since.
Nobody's figured it out. Another bit of good news is coming up in a few months. We're not announcing an official launch date, but coming up is an anthology of your response essays where you respond to critics over the years, sometimes in blogs, sometimes in journals, mm-hmm. But very patiently and specifically. Some of the latest stuff has been this back and forth with Richard Linsky, the great evolutionary biological researcher that you in some ways praise, but also say his own experiments argue against. So some really high-level back and forth.
Yeah.
Your inimitable style, which is gracious but also pithy and pointed. And so that's going to be a fantastic anthology. And it's going to get harder for the Darwinists to say, he's never answered his critics, because all your mini responses won't be scattered here and there on the internet and in journals. Will be in a single anthology, and we'll be able to hold it up and say, did you actually read this?
Yeah, that'll be a great help, because, as I said, people do tend to ignore it. And especially back in the early days of the early 90s, the internet wasn't what it is now, and you couldn't easily put things up that'll last for a long time. So for anybody who actually wants to see how the argument went and what the counter arguments are and what the counter arguments are, this will make it a lot easier.
Right. And we're also planning to make sure it's easy for a reader to find, if it's available, the criticisms leveled against you. If somebody's like, well, he makes them sound really terrible and he's really, really, really destroyed the argument, but were they really that weak? And I want to go find it. He'll actually point you and show you where to go to find their arguments. So he's Michael Behe, from my experience, is more than happy for readers, followers of this debate to go and carefully listen to both sides. But what he doesn't want is people creating straw man versions of his arguments and not engaging his actual arguments. So this will be a great tool. In the meantime, if you don't want to wait to read some of Michael's fantastic writing, Darwin's Black Box, I think there's a 10th anniversary edition, and then the more recent Darwin Devolves, Edge of Evolution, those are all available online right now. Strongly recommend those. And we'll also hear, because we're here at the Science of Faith Conference, we have a very good video recording group here, and we'll be recording at least one, and I think maybe both of your lectures, and those will eventually become available online. You'll be able to find those videos at Discovery Institute's website, discovery.org/ID specifically, Evolution News, our blog. That will also call attention to it. So some great resources already out there, some on the way. Thank you so much, Michael, for joining me here in Texas.
Yeah, thanks very much. It's always a pleasure.
For ID the Future, this has been Jonathan Witt. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.